Hello and welcome to another episode of Meenal's World. This is episode 36 and this week I'm joined by the lovely Femi, who's a British political activist. I'm really glad I managed to get a guest on the show this week. I was a bit worried that that might not happen, but Femi kindly agreed to join me, and I'm so grateful for his time because I came across Femi on Twitter when I started my campaigning, when I started to be more vocal about protecting healthcare workers and taking a stand against the government. And I was always so inspired by his work and his passion to speak up. And not just that, he's really good at calling out the lies of our ministers and leaders and those who are in these positions of power. But I really wanted to know why he was so passionate about this specific issue, which is Brexit. So this is the issue that we're seeing in the UK where we're leaving the European Union. And I wanted to know why he spent the last few years trying to educate people about the system that we live in. And now this goes back to my episode on understanding politics, and what I was trying to say in that episode, and what I'm hoping that episode gave, was that the understanding about how it's important to understand that politics plays a role in your life. And Femi couldn't have put it better. I mean, in this episode, he says that if you're buying something from the supermarket, if you want to go to school, if you want to have an education, just the smallest things in your life, politics plays a role in that. So politics does influence your life, and it really is that simple. And the funny thing is that when I spoke to Femi, it kind of reminded me of my own story, because prior to the pandemic, I wasn't so vocal. I wasn't so interested. I wouldn't say interested. I mean, I've always been interested in politics, but I was never fully emotionally invested in it. And it was kind of a similar story with Femi until he started to study law and he started to work with the EU and understand the importance of the UK to remaining in the European Union. He understood that if the UK left the European Union, it would have an impact on society and it would even impact our generation. So he has been very vocal about the Tory government fabricating lies and creating a story that misled so many voters when it came to the referendum. And he also thought that his voice at one point, I mean, how loud does it have to be for it to make a difference? Because he only started with 20 followers on Twitter and now he has over 200,000 followers, and he just kept going out and talking to people and trying to educate people, which is the key word here, just educate people. And this is the beauty about working at a grassroots level, is that you're not just, I mean, you don't really have the power to make decisions, but you have a power to make change, and maybe you even have more power at a grassroots level as well. And we listened to his TED talk about what it takes to become a political activist, and he speaks about all of this. And even on his TV appearances, you can just see how he's mastered the art of discussion. And, you know, I ask Femi, like, how do you speak to certain people who have completely opposing views? Because even just speaking to my parents about a few things, I'm banging my head on the wall. Like, how can you not get what I'm trying to say? But Femi made a really good point, is that you have to speak in their language and you have to try and put yourselves in their shoes. And I guess to some degree have some sort of compassion. And the beauty of this episode is that a lot of you may be in different parts of the world fighting your own battles, even trying to convince your parents about something, about a certain idea, or you may be sitting in your room thinking, how can I make a change in my country, or how can I make a change in something I believe in so passionately about? And, you know, we've realized that fighting fire with more fire doesn't help. And Femi talks to us about how he's used his platform to educate people. So I'll stop talking now and rambling on about Femi. I'll let him do the talking. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you for joining me today, Femi. I know how busy you are. And if you search your name on YouTube, you've done this many, many times before on much bigger platforms as well. So thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Femi, I personally know a lot about you, and I know the things that you campaign for, the things you talk about a lot, but I really want to start off by learning more about Femi the person. Rather than going into Brexit and your campaigning, I want to know a bit more about you. So from what I've read, your parents are both doctors. And they moved from Nigeria to the UK, is that right?
So yeah, they both trained in Nigeria, and then they came over here in 88 and had me in 1990.
And what was your upbringing like, Femi? I mean, were there lots of conversations at home around politics? Was this something you were raised with, or is this something that came later on?
So pretty much anyone who knows me is shocked that I had the audacity to enter politics, given how little I knew about politics before getting involved directly in politics. I wasn't really paying attention that much. My mum, when she started to see me starting to blow up around politics, she was like, "But Femi, you could barely tell me who the Prime Minister was like a couple of years ago." I remember I did write a poem about the Iraq War when I was 12, just heavily digging into Blair and Bush. But other than that, I can't remember ever having a serious opinion, other than the occasional impression, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman." And that's about it. And then it was only when I did law, realized I didn't want to be a lawyer because I didn't feel I could like save the world as a lawyer. All right, if I'm a lawyer, then I'm just playing in the game. I want to change the rules. How do I change the rules? You got to change the law. How do you change the law? Politics.
Here we are.
Yeah.
So, Femi, if you could just go back to yourself all those years ago, would you tell yourself to be more well-informed within politics? I mean, how important do you think it is for young children to be aware of what's going on in their country?
I definitely tell them to be more aware, because I'd go into schools during the campaign over the last few years, and I would go to 16, 17-year-olds, and the first thing I'd do is I'd say, "All right, everybody, raise your hand if you care about politics." And in many classes, I'd get 2 hands out of 30 go up. And the next question I'd ask is, "Raise your hand if you care how much stuff costs in the shops." All the hands go up. "Raise your hand if you care whether or not you can get a job after school." All the hands go up. "Get treated in the NHS." All the hands go up. And then I say, "Well, that's politics." Mm-hmm. And that's the connection that many people, many young people, and certainly myself at the time, don't really make that connection. Because we just see politics as these old men in suits talking in London and arguing with each other. Nothing to do with how our daily lives, where we're living. That the connection between politics and your life just isn't made for most people.
Mm. And Femi, you went into politics after studying your degree. Was it during that time that you started to see the flaws in the system? Was there something that happened to you specifically? Because when we talk about campaigners and activists, usually a lot of the time it affects them personally, on a personal level, right? My husband and I have been campaigning for the protection of healthcare workers because it affected us directly. Our lives were at risk. And I feel like with a lot of global issues, we only start to take interest when we see a relative get affected or when we see a family member get affected. Now, Brexit is something that we knew would affect our country. We knew it would affect the way the system works, but because our politicians never really broke it down for us in simple terms, I guess a lot of us just sort of gave into the system and said, "Well, this is what it is, we just have to get on with it." Did anything affect you specifically as an individual when it was announced that the Brexit deal was going to happen?
So after law, I moved into human rights, specifically EU human rights. So at the start of 2015, I was working for an NGO in Brussels called the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights. They focused on human rights abuses in the Gulf states, so Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, UAE. And I was watching how the UK was not a good actor in that situation. We were selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which were being used to bomb hospitals and schools in Yemen. We were actively training the police officers who are locking up and beating and torturing human rights defenders here in Sandringham in the UK. And I was watching how, and I was working directly with members of the European Parliament, British members of the European Parliament, who ultimately passed an arms embargo, or at least a resolution for an arms embargo, against the sales to those countries to prevent war crimes. So I was involved in what I very much saw as a battle for the soul of the UK. If you're living abroad, if you're constantly speaking to people from other countries, and you're constantly feeling that shame of, "My country is selling the weapons that kill children," and I felt that the EU was a guarantor on our moral integrity, whereas our government was not. And our government was actually undermining our moral integrity. And so when I heard that Brexit was even a conversation, it just felt, oh, I'm already losing this battle for the soul of the UK. That battle just gets lost if we lose the protection that the EU provides. And so when I was still in Brussels in 2016, I started using Twitter more. This was like in January. And then by March, I'd managed to use my Parliament pass to actually film a video, my very first Brexit video, in the European Parliament to try and get the message out there. And then I came back to the UK. I was delivering pizzas for a few months whilst campaigning on the side on Twitter, on Facebook. Eventually taken to the streets, I bought a t-shirt from Primark, got a felt-tip pen, wrote EU questions, just ask, and stood in the centre of Birmingham for 2 years, for 2 days straight.
Wow.
Just waiting for people to come up to me. Because I had 20 followers on Twitter at the time. Zero platform. And so I was just doing all I could. And then what happened.
So, Femi, when you were stood outside in Birmingham for 2 days, sort of trying to educate people and getting people to come to you, what shocked you the most at that point? I'm sure there was some points where you probably thought, well, how do people not know this, right? Because as someone who's seen so much as a lawyer and during your studies as well, certain things are probably quite obvious to you. But there must have been people who came to you and you probably thought, well, how is it that people have such little information?
Yeah, I mean, there were people. I mean, some of the questions were on the ridiculous side, like, will we still be able to play football in the Euros if we leave the EU? Some of them were the standard questions, like what percentage of our laws are made in the EU. But some of the stuff was ridiculous. Some of this stuff was, if we stay in the EU, then we'll have Sharia law in the UK. Some of the stuff was, but one of the ones that I empathize the most with, even though it's completely illogical, well, mostly illogical, and that's the at least two occasions I had somebody come up to me and say, I'm voting Brexit, nothing you can say to change my mind, but I'm doing this to stick it to Cameron. And after years of austerity, I get the motivation, and it did actually work, it got rid of him, but we're still stuck with this mess 5 years later.
Mm.
I guess one of the ones that hit me the hardest about just how bad and how insidious the Leave campaign was an 80-year-old woman who came up to me with booklets that had been printed out, came up to me in my hometown with these booklets that explained how the Bible was against the EU.
What?
So people had gone to the effort of printing material to manipulate the faith of elderly people in my hometown against the EU.
Wow. I mean, I drew the line when they were plastering all these things on the big red buses, but that is just why I had no idea.
It was one of those ones where oh my god, I'm not equipped to deal with the level of propaganda we're dealing with here.
Yeah, how is this even allowed though? I mean, the line has to be drawn somewhere, right? Like, how does this seep through society, and how does it just happen? How does it not? Why are there no implications to something like this?
Yeah, you would think, but I mean, once that ball got rolling, it didn't matter how illegitimate it was. We're sitting on a vote that was, I mean, people, and the thing I'm about to say, they get played off as excuses. The fact that the campaign that won broke the law by overspending by £449,000. The fact that the referendum wasn't supposed to be legally binding, and in fact the reason why they didn't set a 60% supermajority minimum threshold for it to count as a victory was because it was they told parliamentarians that it wouldn't be legally binding, and that's how we ended up with the situation we're in. But nothing in that, everything was just allowed to slide as it's the will of the people, it's a referendum, it's holy, it's sacrosanct.
Wow. Now, Femi, you must have come across, I mean, you have come across a lot of people who are really passionate about the complete opposite about what you're passionate about, right? Like, they have the same energy and the same passion that Brexit is the right thing. Now, let's if we zoom out a little bit, of course, there's so many discussions happening in the world right now. We talk about racism, anti-Semitism, and with a pandemic, we've seen so many discussions open up, and we've seen the realities of our government sort of simmer to the surface now. You've been on many debates, and I guess the role that you have as a campaigner is to try and maybe not fully change the ideas of people, but get them thinking, get the ball rolling for them to think. Now, how do you do that, Femi? Because I've seen in the last few months that once someone is stuck in their ways, they create this box around themselves and this brick wall where they say, I'm not going to listen to anything else but this. And with the rise of social media as well, we tend to create our own sort of ecosystem, right? This echo chamber where we follow certain people, we follow certain groups that reflect our views as well. As a campaigner and activist, how do you break out of this? And how do you try? And to some degree, you have to empathize with these people.
Yeah, and that's one of the difficult things. I think too many people in this conversation argued exclusively from their own perspective. You don't convince anybody if you only argue from your own perspective. I'd often start when I give presentations. I'd start with a joke from Ricky Gervais. He said that when Brits go abroad, we will go to a French restaurant and we will say, "Do you have chips?" If that doesn't work louder, we'll say a bit louder, "Do you have chips?" If that doesn't work louder, we say, "Do you have chips?" If that doesn't work, we'll smash the place up, content with the knowledge we've tried our best. That's the attitude of many Remainers, to be honest, about how to convince people to sway to their side. If you do not speak the language of the person you're trying to convince, they will not hear you. If you go to a hardcore Brexiteer and you start waving an EU flag in their face, they see that as an invading force. That's the flag of the enemy in their eyes. That is not the language that you speak. And so when I'd speak to Brexiteers, I would first of all ask, well, what do you want from Brexit?
Mm.
They would say sovereignty. All right, so I'd lay it out. Right now, the UK has 73 of the 750 members of the European Parliament. That gives us 3 times the voting weight of the average EU country. That's the level of control that we currently have, or had at the time. What Theresa May was offering at the time was, keep following the rules, but with no say. Logically, that's less control. So that thing that you want is being undermined by the thing that you voted for.
Mm.
That's how you argue from their perspective.
Mm. Well, Femi, it's an interesting thing you said about speaking their language. Now, you're a lawyer. So do you think your law degree has helped you in having these conversations?
So I basically took my law degree and ran. I didn't actually qualify as a lawyer. I just wanted to be able to arm the skill. I studied law because I knew I could argue well, and I wanted to be able to arm that skill as best as I could. But yeah, definitely in terms of... to be honest, I'd say that my skills in terms of seeing other people's points of view, I've had that all the time. I've always been the mediator in the family. And splitting up debates, acting as a lawyer for both sides in any front family debate, that's always been my role. The law just gave me the knowledge that I needed to deal with the issue deal with this Brexit issue.
But when you went into this law degree, your plan was to come out as a lawyer.
That was the plan, but this sort of dips into that earlier question as to what things made you feel that you need to get active. One of the reasons I decided not to be a lawyer is because I realised that you couldn't argue, judge, do this because it's the right thing. You had to argue, judge, do this because a judge 100 years ago also did this. So it's precedent, not morality. And I didn't like some of the rules. For example, at the time, they've changed it since. But at the time, when I was studying, the test for theft... means basically you need to get something and use something in a dishonest way. And the test for if it's honest can be twofold. Either the jury thinks your actions were honest, or the jury concludes that the defendant believed that the average person would do the same or would think that their actions were honest. Now, the problem with that is bad people, by definition, don't think they're bad. Bad people have a lower moral standing. A more decent person is more likely to judge their actions more harshly. So under those circumstances, a decent person is more likely to go to jail than a bad person. Because the bad person is more likely to think, well, everyone else would have done the same thing.
Mm.
And it's that sort of thing that made me think, all right, there needs to be some more morality in how the country is run.
Femi, in one of your TED Talks, you mentioned that you spoke about how you also were all sitting in a car and were about to drive off a cliff, but there was nobody at the wheel. And yeah. Someone has to come and sit at the driver's seat and take control. You decided to take that position and you said, I'm going to take control and I'm going to vocalize my concerns. Now, at the time in 2016, you didn't have this Twitter platform that you have now. You didn't have the following that you have now. But you just put on your t-shirt and you went out on the streets of Birmingham and you tried to make the change that you felt that you could. Now, it's a very scary position to take because the world of politics, our government, our leaders, they're working at a completely different scale to what we are working at a grassroots level. I mean, my husband and I, for example, when we try to speak to people about how our government made certain decisions which affected us as doctors in the NHS, for example, it was scary because we were making a stand against a big organization. For me at least, I wasn't sure what change I could make as a pregnant South Asian woman. Who would listen to me? What gave you that fire to say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make sure that I do everything I can. I'm going to use every fiber of my being to make sure that people are educated.
Where does it come from? Long-standing hero complex due to watching too many superhero shows. being raised on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and
all. So is that what I need to do with Radhika then? Just put lots of superhero films on?
Oh, 100%. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Get her to watch every single episode because that is the. I mean, I've got a poster up on my wall framed from that of a quote that says, "Nothing in the world is the way it ought to be. It's harsh and cruel, but that's why there's us. Mm. Doesn't matter where we come from, what we've done or suffered, or even if we make a difference, live as though the world were as it should be to show it what it can be."
Mm.
That is what I live my life by. It's not about necessarily the belief that your actions are definitely going to save the day, save the world, turn everything around. You have to do it because it has to be done. You have to at least try, otherwise the world is screwed.
Hmm. Were you involved in anything else before Brexit? Or was this your first sort of big thing that you got your hands into?
Like I said, I was working in Brussels on human rights affairs for an NGO that will focus on human rights in the Gulf states. I then moved into an NGO that was focused on anti-lobbying. And then in 2017, I moved to Vienna to the EU Fundamental Rights Agency. So I was actually working for the human rights branch of the EU, doing a traineeship there as their advocacy intern. And I quit that 2 months before the end of the 12-month internship to come back to the UK and fight Brexit.
So Femi, your parents are from Nigeria, and I would assume that to some extent they probably must have been a bit scared that you were taking the stand and that you were fighting a system that could potentially crush you, right? When I went outside Downing Street, my parents were concerned about my job and they said, well, you know, as someone who's not white, you know, who's going to listen to you. Yeah. What was that like for your parents and for your family? And how, I mean, did you have to convince them that you were just going to carry on because you felt it was the right thing?
They've been very, very worried at several points during this. I mean, you've seen the abuse that I get on Twitter. It's every minute. During the height of things, it was abuse every minute, racial abuse every 2 days, threats of violence every couple of weeks, threats of killing every couple of months, and then in January 2018, somebody posted my home address online.
Oh.
Fortunately, I had moved out of that address about a month prior, but still. So yeah, it's the sort of thing that it doesn't exactly make a parent feel comfortable, and yeah, so it. But they knew that I made it very, very clear to them that I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do if I didn't throw everything at this. So they accepted that.
And Femi, is there anything else in your, I mean, from your parents' background and from Nigeria, for example, that you also feel really passionate about, that you want to sort of speak about more? Or are you mainly focused on, you know, trying to educate people in the UK itself?
I mean, the stuff that I have comments to pass on Nigeria, but I don't dig into it on the basis that I haven't lived there, and therefore I don't feel as confident in my knowledge of Nigerian society as I would do have it if I'd lived there. Comments that I'd use, I'd say, would be that I believe procurement laws need to be massively tightened up in Nigeria, because infrastructural projects just seem to go nowhere from what I've heard from people from my family who live over there. But it's not really something that I could campaign on because I don't know the details.
Do you go back to Nigeria often? Or
I've been there 4 times for a total of about 4 weeks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what's it like when you go back? I mean, because that's where your roots lie. That's where your family is from. Because when I go back to India sometimes, I'm usually in disbelief that how did we go from there to coming here to the UK? I feel like sometimes it seems like I'm living in a film. Like, I can't believe sometimes that my parents were born in New Delhi, and my dad especially living in the slums, from that to this. I mean, how did that even happen? And obviously when I go back, there's a big sense of gratitude that I can live in a country where I have more opportunities, and I can live in a country where I can raise my voice when I'm concerned. What goes through your mind when you go back home?
Yeah, there's a very large sense of, not survivor's guilt, but that sense of I don't deserve to be in the position that I am. If I was born 2 doors down, I'd be stuck there. Stuck there meaning I'd be in relative poverty compared to where I am now. And that knowledge of seeing people that I could very easily have been in their shoes really just, it knocks away any of that. I've often said that there are 2 types of privilege. There's privilege that thinks it deserves it and privilege that knows it doesn't. And so that first type of thinking you deserve the things that you have just vanishes when you see how life could have been if not for chance.
And I guess it gives you more of a fire to try and make the world a better place, because when you see something like that, you realize the power that you have. Femi, I want to go back to that TED talk I was talking about, because it just came to mind, and you mentioned something that really struck a chord with me. You spoke about the single market, and you said that it was mentioned so many times on the news, and within 5 months, no one really explained it on the media. It was coming out every day. And you explained it within 30 seconds in your talk. Now, why do you think, and I've come to realize this as well, I've only understood the system by doing my own reading and my own research, and it takes a lot of personal effort to do that. Why do you think a lot of these, to what it seems to us, simple terms and simple procedures are actually not explained to us?
So the Leave campaign had zero incentive to explain those things, because if you don't understand that the single market is primarily about regulations, then the narrative of taking back control of our laws, there's no counter to that. I want to take back control of my laws. Is there a downside? No. So they had no incentive. As for the Remain side, they may have tried to explain it a couple of times, but to be honest, it may have been a general, either a lack of belief in the intelligence of most people, and therefore they felt that they couldn't understand it, or they genuinely felt that it would be easier to manipulate people if you just go with the big headline figures of 100,000 jobs lost if you vote for Brexit, immediate recession, all that stuff. And what they did by doing that was not only did they allow people to think they understood the single market when they didn't, but by focusing, by using what I would genuinely agree was Project Fear, by saying that all the damage would come from a vote to leave rather than us actually leaving, they undermined the basic credibility of, well, the trust in experts by saying that the experts are saying the damage will happen immediately because it didn't.
Mm. Now, Femi, it seems like you're doing the job that our leaders should be doing. And I say this because even my husband and I, when we were campaigning for protection of healthcare workers, I was like, well, why aren't our leaders trying to get us more PPE? Why aren't our leaders trying to protect pregnant women? Why aren't our leaders trying to protect those from ethnic minority groups? I mean, I would have thought these were the questions that would be on the tips of their tongues, you know, when they have these meetings and when they're in Downing Street, number 10. So it begs a question, Femi, how much change can we actually make at a grassroots level? Or can we only really make the change we want to make once we step foot into politics?
So ultimately, take back control was a powerful narrative in 2016 because everybody felt powerless across the board. And I think a large part of that is due to our voting system, because campaigning is important, but it has so much less power if your MP knows he's in a safe seat. And because of that, I can understand why people feel powerless at the grassroots level, because you know, I mean, so many times over the past few years, I've spoken to people who are just like, yeah, we've made that argument, but this area has been Tory since 1933.
Oh.
What are we going to do? Yeah, they know that their MP has no incentive to do anything to listen to them at all, because why would they? They've got the whip. They're more scared of that than they are of voters.
Mm. Would you ever consider going into politics? Do you think that you can make bigger change if you were in the system?
I think I genuinely think that if I was on TV once a week, I would have more power than if I was in Parliament.
Mm.
Because I've always, I, for all intents and purposes, I'm an influencer. And I much rather get people to do things based on the strength of my argument than by actively having the power to make things happen.
Mm.
I want to change the narrative. I want to change the conversation. I want to improve and elevate the conversation much more than I want to actively be the one making the decisions.
So you think that you can have more of an impact on society by educating people and putting the information out there, and then essentially people can decide what they want to do with that information.
Exactly. There may come a day where I do step onto the ballot paper. That may happen. And it's ironic that, I mean, to be that, you have to at least want power, at least to some extent. And given that I don't, power attracts those who are hungry for power. And that's kind of the problem. So you do have to have people that have no interest in power who ultimately go for it at some point. But yeah.
Femi, the thing is that the whole political system is so, it's quite a scary thing to even think about, right? I mean, if you talk about yourself, and even if someone asked me as well, I'd be like, oh, it's a bit scary because these people seem to know how to get the way around things. I mean, you look at Matt Hancock coming on TV, the way he bluffs, the way he's sort of trained to dodge questions, and the way he's trained to, I guess, to some extent, act on TV as well. Yep. And I feel that, I don't know, do you feel that there is no way to stay true to yourself when you enter politics? Do you feel like at any level that even the most pure person will be corrupted?
I think there's an element of that, yes, on the basis that I know that I've had to make decisions about, well, I've had to stay quiet on things that I don't want to stay quiet about, because I've known what the reality is I'm dealing with. For example, during the Brexit campaign, even though I know that immigration is a net benefit to the UK, I was also acutely aware that the explanation as to why immigration is a net benefit from for the UK is not something that the people are going to change their minds on in the potentially 10 months that I had until there was going to be a general election or referendum. So rather than go on that angle, I would either just do the angle I'm about to say, or do the two-pronged approach of saying, all right, here are the regulations in the EU that allow you to control immigration, so it's actually better controlled under the EU than it would be if we left the EU. And so having to swallow the principled position of here's why we should be a more inclusive society in favor of, okay, you hate foreigners, here's my argument to help you with that. And having to swallow my tongue on things like that's the sort of thing that makes me really uncomfortable. But I'm also somebody that's very utilitarian. If it's necessary for the greater good, I'll do it.
Femi, in the last few months, I would say we've seen a huge shift in our society. A lot of, as I said, a lot of issues have simmered to the surface, and we've become much more acutely aware of who our leaders are and the role that they have in trying to create, I guess, what we would like, a balanced society. How do you think the last few months have changed the sort of the course of our generation, at least? And I say this in terms of the pandemic, we've seen Black Lives Matter movements become much more powerful. What do you think the next few years will look like now?
So I think as we exit this pandemic and we enter Brexit properly, young people in the UK are going to be absolutely furious. They've had their freedoms curtailed because the government failed to control the virus properly. They've had their grades literally stolen from them. They are forced into a Brexit that they did not vote for. Voted twice against, MP Tobias Elwood in December last year, or maybe just before, he actually went on TV during the time where Parliament was voting as to whether or not to allow 16 and 17 year olds to be able to vote in the general election, and he said that now is not the right time because we know that it would probably favour a particular party. So he literally said that it's because they'd vote Labour and because we're at a crucial time for Brexit, i.e. if we gave young people a say, we'd stay in the EU. We can't allow that. That I will never forgive. Young people will never forgive that. So we're going to have a lot of angry young people at the end of this. And that will... I'm hoping that we can channel that into something productive to make sure that it unites the left, gets proportional representation, gets an electoral pact, gets rid of the Tories for good.
Yeah. Now, Femi, obviously we've got listeners all over the world here, and people are listening to you now thinking, well, I am passionate about a certain issue in my country. I'm passionate about something else. How can I make my voice heard? Because right now social media is quite different to what it was in 2016. And the internet is a whole different place, I would say. And I guess we feel as young people that a voice gets drowned amongst everybody else who's trying to fight for the same thing. So if someone wants to speak up or if someone wants to campaign, what is your advice to them?
My advice would be to get to know the conversation in the space that you want to get involved in. Really know it. Know all the arguments. Follow the people that are on the other side of the argument. Know all of the arguments they make. Every response they have to the arguments on your side of the argument. And then figure out what is missing from the conversation. Figure out exactly, because in any debate there will be these two sides that keep going at each other and never really, they'll have parallel debates whereby they're actually arguing about different things really. And in their terms, they're right, and the other side is arguing on completely different terms, and there's no link between the two, but they're just shouting at each other. Figure out how those two narratives link together. find that link, and then you will be, your voice will be very, very powerful, because you'll be providing something that nobody else has seen.
Well, thank you, Femi. I really appreciate that. I think that's really important, a point that you made, that when we try to have an argument or discussion with somebody, that empathy usually is lacking. And I think when we understand, when we put ourselves in their shoes, I think that's when we can have a productive conversation. I think a lot of us have to understand as well that we can't fully change someone's train of thought, especially if they've been thinking like that for decades. You know, it's very difficult. Exactly. But I think if you just plant the seed and just drop it there and say, okay, let this grow in its own time.
And let the next person carry it a bit further.
Exactly, yeah. And then the conversation grows from there. And I think a lot of us have to come to that understanding as well, that we might not see the change we want to see while we're alive. And that's something that I found very difficult to accept, knowing that my own daughter, Radhika, she might live in the same world that I've been seeing as well. And that's not what I want. But if it takes that long, then it takes that long. But we just have to sort of accept that. And I think once we come to that acceptance, I think a lot more of us will be driving towards the same direction.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time, Femi. I really enjoyed this conversation. And
me too.
If anybody wants to follow you, how can they do that? Is it Twitter your main handle, or is it?
I'm Twitter, Facebook, TikTok.
You're on TikTok, YouTube. Femi? I need to see this.
I do have a couple of lipsticks, okay. So yeah, brace yourself.
That's the first thing I'm going to do now when I end this call. Check Femi out on TikTok. Thank you, Femi, and I hope a lot of people will be inspired and encouraged after listening to your story.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Femi. Thank you, dear listeners, and thank you, dear Femi, as well, for joining me today. I'm so grateful to have connected with Femi on Twitter, and not just Femi, so many other campaigners and activists who are trying to help others and who are lifting other people up in their own battles as well. And that's the beauty of the internet, that's the beauty of social media, if it's used in the right way. So you can follow Femi on Twitter. I'll leave his links in the description below. You can get in touch with him as well. He's a great guy and always, always happy to help young people in their own journeys as well. You can find all my episodes on meanalsworldpodcast.com. You can drop me an email, meanalsworldpodcast@gmail.com. You can drop me a message on Instagram as well, @meanalsworld. I have more guests lined up for you. And thank you, everybody who gives me their time every week. Thank you for listening in. Thank you for sending your questions. I'm really enjoying these Tuesday morning podcasts that I'm doing as well on the side. It's a nice outlet. And the questions you send them are quite funny from time to time. So it's a nice light episode that I like to put out every week. So I hope you all have a lovely weekend, sending you lots of love and a lot of power and a lot of courage to stand up for anything that you believe in. And we're all here together to fight all these battles that we're facing every day. So sending you lots of love, and I'll see you all on Tuesday.